Others
Hi,
will be.
I'm Mimi Goodman, host of Democracy Now!
It's time for Democracy
more than
Now!
15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We believe the shooting was committed by a single suspect who is now in custody. The suspect chanted, "Free, free Palestine," while in custody.
Two staffers at the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. were shot dead last night outside the Capitol Jewish Museum by a man who shouted "Free Palestine" while being detained. We'll get response from the Israeli journalist Gideon Levy in Tel Aviv. Then to a doctor in Gaza as Israel kills another 51 Palestinians so far today.
So if Nasser is evacuated, we really are looking at the imminent death of hundreds of patients because we won't be able to take them anywhere. So it's probably all we're worrying about at the moment and just praying and hoping that the IDF don't get any closer to us.
Plus, we look at how criticism of Israel is growing in Europe as the UK pauses trade talks with Israel and the EU reviews its relationship with the country. And we go to South Africa a day after South African President Cyril Ramaphosa meets with President Trump in the Oval Office, calmly rejecting Trump's false claims about a white genocide in South Africa.
I would say if there was Afrikaner farmer genocide, I can bet you these three gentlemen would not be here, including my Minister of Agriculture. They would not be with me.
President Ramaphosa also joked about not having a plane to give President Trump, referring to the $400 million luxury plane that the Pentagon has just accepted as a gift from Qatar for Trump. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's military has intensified its attacks on the Gaza Strip and its civilian population, killing at least 51 Palestinians since dawn. Thousands of Palestinian families have been forced to flee northern Gaza after Israel issued new forced evacuation orders for Beit Lahia and Jabalia. Gaza's health ministry reports Israel bombed three electric power generators and fuel storage tanks at the besieged Indonesian hospital. They've also surrounded Gaza's Al-Auda hospital. With Israel's latest attacks, only 19 of Gaza's 38 hospitals are still operating, albeit at a severely limited capacity. On Wednesday, Israel allowed just 100 trucks carrying humanitarian aid into Gaza, a tiny fraction of the 9,000 that Israel's continuing to hold up at Gaza's border amidst a near-total blockade on food, water and medicine. UN officials say that trickle of aid is far short of what's needed to prevent a famine and hasn't even been distributed yet due to extremely difficult conditions faced by humanitarian workers. Starving children have been lining up for hours at a community kitchen in Gaza City, hoping for a meal.
I've been standing since morning and everyone is pushing. It's a huge number of people trying just to get food. Everyone is rushing in. How can I fill my plate? I can't. Every day is like this. People come from inside and outside the camp for food. I've been here since early morning. I tried to rush in and get some food, but I can't.
In the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers fired shots Wednesday toward a delegation of foreign diplomats on an official mission to observe the humanitarian situation in the Jenin refugee camp. Video shows the European Union, Arab and Asian diplomats conducting interviews near Jenin's entrance when shots ring out. Israeli soldiers were seen pointing rifles at the diplomats. The incident drew official protests and statements of condemnation from Italy, France, Turkey, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Ireland, Spain, and the EU's foreign policy chief, among others. In Washington, D.C., police have arrested a suspect in the shooting death of two Israeli embassy employees Wednesday evening. Yaron Lischinsky and Sarah Lynn Milgram, who are a couple, were exiting the Capitol Jewish Museum when 30-year-old Elias Rodriguez of Chicago allegedly opened fire on them. Video of the aftermath shows Rodriguez shouting, "Free Palestine," as he's led away in handcuffs. After headlines, we'll go to Tel Aviv to speak with the Israeli journalist Gideon Levy. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa visited the White House Wednesday, where President Trump used their Oval Office appearance to push false claims that white Afrikaner farmers are facing a genocide. During an extraordinary confrontation broadcast live on TV, Trump had the lights dimmed and ordered video clips played showing people calling for violence against white farmers in South Africa. One clip showed white crosses marking what Trump falsely called burial sites of, quote, over 1,000, he said, white farmers. In fact, they were part of a protest against farm violence, not actual graves. South African police data show farm murders comprise less than 0.2% of murders between October and December of last year in South Africa. This is President Ramaphosa responding to Trump's ambush.
They're a small minority party, which is allowed to exist in terms of our constitution.
But you do allow them to take land.
No.
You do allow them to take land.
Nobody can take land.
And then when they take the land, they kill the white farmer. And when they kill the white farmer, nothing happens to them.
No. There is criminality in our country. People who do get killed, unfortunately, through criminal activity, are not only white people. Majority of them are black people.
This month, the Trump administration granted refugee status to a group of 59 white South Africans, even as it suspended refugee resettlement for almost everyone else in the world. Trump's claims of white genocide come after South Africa brought a genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice in The Hague. Also attending the Oval Office meeting was the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, who was from South Africa. A federal judge on Wednesday ruled the Trump administration violated a court order when it expelled 8 immigrants this week to South Sudan without giving them at least 15 days to challenge their removal. Judge Brian Murphy said immigration officials had only given the men 24 hours notice, but Murphy did not order the men to be returned to the U.S. as their lawyers had requested. Their plane is believed to have landed in Djibouti Wednesday, but it's not clear if it would continue on to South Sudan, which observers fear could be on the brink of a new civil war. Only one of the men is from South Sudan. The others are from Cuba, Mexico, Laos, Vietnam, and Burma. This comes amidst mounting reports of ICE arrests outside immigration courts as agents prey on people who are dutifully appearing for their hearings. Community members have started showing up to courts to protest the arrests and inform immigrants of their rights. Immigration lawyers fear the arrests will scare people into skipping their court hearings, making them subject to possible immediate deportation. House Republicans have passed Trump's sweeping budget bill that gives massive tax breaks to the rich while slashing spending for Medicaid, nutritional assistance, subsidies for clean energy. The measure just eked through in a 215 to 214 vote this morning. Senate Republicans, who voiced some concerns over the measure, will now have to pass their own version of the budget. With all Democratic senators opposed to the package, Republicans could resort to using the reconciliation process to avoid a filibuster. The Pentagon has accepted the luxury $400 million Boeing jet from Qatar, which will eventually be used as a new Air Force One if it's retrofitted in time. Ethics experts have raised concerns over the legality of the gifts, as well as the cost of retrofitting the plane, which could cost upwards of $1 billion. The plane will eventually be transferred to Trump's presidential library, where he continued using it after leaving office. Senate Republicans on Wednesday blocked a bill authored by Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer that would have barred the Pentagon from spending any taxpayer money on the jet. In other news from D.C., officials from the U.S. Institute for Peace returned to their offices Wednesday after a federal judge ruled the Trump administration engaged in a, quote, gross usurpation of power, unquote, when it took over the Independent Institute earlier this year and ejected its leaders as part of Elon Musk's rampage against federal agencies. Judge Beryl Howell declared the White House takeover null and void. Pakistan has blamed Indian terror proxies, they say, for an attack on a school bus in southwestern Balochistan province Wednesday, which killed at least six people, three of them children. India has rejected any involvement in the attack, which comes at a time of heightened tensions between the two countries. Just days earlier, a car bomb killed four more people in Balochistan. The region has seen years of bloody conflict between the Pakistani government and Baloch separatists. The father of three boys killed in Wednesday's school bus attack implored warring parties to halt the deadly attacks.
For God's sake, we are neither terrorists nor do we like terrorism. We are peace-loving people. For God's sake, forgive our children. We have left our region and homeland for you. What else can we do? You have targeted my innocent children. For God's sake, we have no other way. Have mercy on our situation.
In Britain, Leyla Swaif, the mother of the imprisoned British-Egyptian activist Ali Abdel Fattah, has resumed an almost total hunger strike to demand the release of her son. She spoke in front of the Prime Minister's residence at 10 Downing Street Tuesday as she applies pressure on the UK government to secure the freedom of her son, who's also on hunger strike in an Egyptian prison.
The Prime Minister made a promise to me and to Parliament to do all he could to free Ali. A few days ago, my daughter Mona received a truly humane letter from Mr. Starmer assuring all of my family of his continued support. But for Ali, sitting in prison, now on hunger strike, for 81 days since the 1st of March, nothing has changed.
Egyptian authorities have kept Ali Abdel Fattah behind bars for most of the last decade over his human rights advocacy. And the Justice Department is dismissing police reform and oversight agreements in Minneapolis and Louisville just days ahead of the five-year anniversary of the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, May 25th, 2020. The consent decrees came in response to Floyd's murder, as well as the Louisville police killing of Breonna Taylor, March 13th, 2025, after federal investigations found patterns of unconstitutional and racist policing practices in both cities. The Trump administration disputed those findings and dismissed the consent decrees as federal micromanagement. The DOJ is also ending civil rights investigations into police departments in Memphis, Phoenix, Oklahoma City, Trenton, New Jersey, and Mount Vernon, New York. Both Minneapolis and Louisville, which are run by Democratic mayors, said they would nonetheless move ahead with the planned reforms. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Two staffers at the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. were shot dead last night outside the Capitol Jewish Museum. This is D.C. Police Chief Pamela Smith.
We believe the shooting was committed by a single suspect who is now in custody. Prior to the shooting, the suspect was observed pacing back and forth outside of the museum. He approached a group of four people, produced a handgun, and opened fire, striking both of our decedents. After the shooting, the suspect then entered the museum and was detained by event security. Once in handcuffs, the suspect identified where he discarded the weapon, and that weapon has been recovered, and he implied that he committed the offense.
Israel's foreign ministry identified the shooting victims as 30-year-old Yaron Leshinsky and Sarah Lynn Milgram. They both worked at the Israeli embassy and were about to be engaged. They'd been attending a private event at the Capitol Jewish Museum. According to one of the organizers, the event focused on advancing humanitarian aid efforts for Gaza. Authorities arrested 30-year-old Elias Rodriguez of Chicago, who was filmed shouting in support of Palestinians as he was being detained.
The journalist Ken Klippenstein posted what is believed to be a manifesto by the alleged gunman, Elias Rodriguez. In the document, he praises Aaron Bushnell, the U.S. Air Force person who self-immolated last year in an act of protest outside the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. Rodriguez wrote, quote, Aaron Bushnell and others sacrificed themselves in the hopes of stopping the massacre, and the state works to make us feel their sacrifice was made in vain, that there is no hope in escalating for Gaza and no point in bringing the war home. We can't let them succeed. Their sacrifices were not made in vain.
We go now to Tel Aviv, where we're joined by the Israeli journalist Gideon Levy, an award-winning Israeli journalist, author, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, member of its editorial board. Gideon Levy's latest book is titled The Killing of Gaza, Reports on a Catastrophe. Thank you so much for being with us, Gideon. If you could first respond to the killing of these two staffers, a couple who walked outside of this American Jewish Committee event at the Jewish Museum in Washington last night.
I mean, this incident can be only condemned. Nothing that Israel is doing can justify such a murder. It was a murder. And unfortunately, also, this kind of violence will not bring the Gaza war to its end. So it's tasteless, it's criminal, it's tragic. Two young people being murdered. It doesn't serve anything, and it should be condemned and not justified by anything. Nothing can justify it.
And Gideon, if you could just talk about what the preliminary response in Israel has been and whether you anticipate anything happening as a direct consequence of this murder?
No, I don't expect anything in particular connected with this murder. But the general atmosphere in Israel starts to be realizing that because of the war in Gaza, Israel is turning into a pariah state. People start to digest it, start to understand that there will be a price for all the crimes, for the mass killing, for the destruction. And the longer this war will go on, the more damage will be made also to Israel. First, the main damage is obviously to the real direct victims in Gaza. But also Israel is going to pay a price for running this war for so long with so little justification, legitimacy, or purpose.
Well, Gideon, if you could talk about your latest column, Israel's military leaders are not only obeying orders, they could have stopped the Gaza massacre. If you could elaborate on what you say in the piece.
Sure. There is a tendency mainly among my friends in the Zionist left or in the central left of Israel to put everything on the shoulders of the government, which is right to do, but to give some immunity to the army, as if the army is still the old holy cow of Israel. I cannot accept it, because finally the children, almost 1,000 babies, can you imagine yourself, almost 1,000 babies in 19 months, not to speak about the 17,000 children. They were killed by soldiers. They were killed by pilots. They were killed by people who have to take accountability for this. Yes, the government decides about the policy, and the government should be blamed for such a policy. But by the end of the day, we cannot say it's only the government, because the army did it. There are almost no refuseniks in this war, which is quite surprising. There are some, but very few, and for sure not public ones. And all the others are committing a criminal policy, a policy with a black flag on it, a policy which is very clear, does not meet any of the articles of the international law. And therefore, to say we don't attack the army, we don't criticize the army, it's only the government, is really doing our life too easy. Yes, the army is very popular in Israel. We have to break this militarism once and for all and say, yes, the government is to be blamed, but so does the army. Everyone who took part in this bloodbath should be taken accountable.
Gideon Levy, we thank you so much for being with us. We hope to get back to you next week. Apparently, the Israeli government is going to hold a conference next week in Jerusalem on anti-Semitism, attended by ministers from member states of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. This, as the opposition Israel Democratic Party head, Yair Golan, condemns the Netanyahu government's siege of Gaza during an interview with Israeli public radio, saying, quote, "Israel's on its way to becoming a pariah state among nations like South Africa was if we don't return to acting like a sane country. And a sane country doesn't wage war against civilians, does not kill babies as a hobby, and does not give itself the aim of expelling population." Again, those the words of Yair Golan, who is with the opposition Israel Democratic Party. We're going to turn right now to Gaza. Go directly to Gaza. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.
Israel's military has intensified its attacks on the Gaza Strip, killing at least 51 Palestinians since dawn. Gaza's health ministry reports Israel bombed three electric power generators and fuel storage tanks at the besieged Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza. They've also surrounded Gaza's Al-Awda hospital. With Israel's latest attacks, only 19 of Gaza's 38 hospitals are still operating, albeit at severely limited capacity.
We go now to Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, where we're joined by Dr. Victoria Rose, a British senior plastic and reconstructive surgeon with the National Health Service. She's been on three medical missions to Gaza since October 2023. We're talking to her on the day this week after it's been announced by Britain that they're going to pause trade talks with Israel, given what is happening in Gaza right now. Dr. Victoria Rose, tell us what's happening there. What are you finding?
So we arrived about we arrived on the 13th of May, and we've been working at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis since the 15th. As you said, it's not my first trip, so there's some comparisons here. But the main thing that's different really is the state of the population. I mean, it's very clear that we're dealing with a completely different patient population now. These people haven't had any food in since the 2nd of March. They are malnourished. The children are particularly taking the brunt of this. They are all a lot shorter than their Western counterparts. That's always been a problem from their chronic malnutrition. But they are very, very thin. We are having a lot of problems with wound healing, because obviously if you're not getting enough nutrients and vitamins, your cells are not turning over in a timely fashion and you can't heal your wounds. On top of that, we are having dire problems with infection. This is related to the malnutrition, but also related to the situation that the people are in. They are living in tents. It's dirty. We're running out of clean water. Israel have stopped the vaccination programs. It's the worst it's ever been.
And Dr. Rose, if you could say, you know, what kinds of injuries are you seeing most often, and particularly on children?
So they're all blast and bomb injuries. And there's there's two types of wounds that you see from a bomb going off or an explosion. The first is a burn from the heat of the explosion, and we're seeing some huge burns, 40-50% burns in children, the sort of burns that are very rarely survivable in the UK when we have all of our intensive care colleagues around us and specialist hospitals. We still have problems supporting children with this size burn in the UK. So you can imagine what that burn is like over here. The other injuries that we're seeing are due to the penetration of the missiles. So what happens in a blast is whatever is around you, either the local masonry or a car or whatever was blown up with you, is ejected at a very high speed and it hits the civilians like a missile. This will either penetrate the head, chest or abdomen, and if it does that, you're unlikely to survive. If it penetrates a limb, you're likely to survive and you'll be brought to a hospital. What we're seeing is traumatic amputations of hands, fingers, feet, toes, legs, arms. And what isn't amputated is severely destructed. So we are trying to piece together bones, patch missing bits of skin, nerves are damaged, really, really severe injuries.
So, Dr. Rose, you're describing these severe injuries on a large number of children, but you're also working with very little medicine. If you could, explain how you're doing this surgical work with access to such few anesthetics.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing that we're low on at the moment is antibiotics. We ran out of Augmentin or Coamoxiclav, which is the most standard antibiotic that we use in these type of injuries. And we're down to a very weaker substitute, ceftriaxone, which we don't actually use in the UK now. And that's our real problem, is that we're not giving adequate antibiotics to these people. We just don't have them.
And Dr. Rose, Nasser Hospital is not far from the fighting. Could you talk about your concerns about a possible forced evacuation, and if such were to occur, where the patients at Nasser would go?
Yeah, we're checking the IDF website, which is idf.il. And if you're in Gaza, it picks up your location immediately, and they've gridded the entirety of the strip. We are basically a grid away from the active fighting, so about four streets, about a K and a half from the evacuation zone. We had dire problems on Tuesday when that zone was announced, in that quite a lot of my team had to leave me to go and evacuate their families. My anaesthetist today, on Tuesday, walked 20K with his 5, 6, and 8-year-old. To evacuate them from where they lived in East Khan Yunis into Almawasi, which is the humanitarian zone. So we had a real problem with staff on Tuesday, but our main issue is we are the last standing hospital in the south of Gaza. The European Gaza Hospital was taken on Wednesday of last week. And the only other hospitals around us are field hospitals. So there's some good field hospitals. There's the UK Med, ICRC, MSF Belgium. There's also the Jordanian and the Kuwait hospital. But they are all tents. These are all tent hospitals that don't have any ICU capacity, and they don't have any generated oxygen. The only standing hospital around us is the Palestinian Red Cross Society, but that's part tents, and that, again, doesn't have an ICU, and it can't generate its own oxygen. So if Nasser closes, we have a huge issue on our hands, because we have an adult ICU and a pediatric ICU, and we have nowhere to send these patients. Anyone here at the moment that's dependent on oxygen is also at risk. If Nasser closes, hundreds of patients will die.
Let me ask you, Dr. Rose, if news of what's happening in the outside world is coming to you, in a moment we're going to talk to the former Labour leader of Britain, Jeremy Corbyn, but the fact that Israel's staunchest allies, UK, your own country, where the Prime Minister Starmer has said that the suffering of the innocent children being bombed again is utterly intolerable, and we're going to speak with an EU representative where the European Union is also putting pressure on Israel. Does that make a difference? And what are you ultimately calling for?
It has made a difference. It does feel like finally our voices are being heard. But it is a shame that it comes so late. And I think we need a little bit more action than what we're seeing. Really, what we need is an end to this enforced blockade. As I said, we haven't had any aid or any food in since the 2nd of March. And the 9 trucks that came in yesterday are still parked in Israeli territory in Gaza, and the Palestinian trucks have not been allowed to pick them up. So it's really dire. I think we need to put the politics aside here. It's a humanitarian crisis, and Israel has got to open the borders to let food in, to let medical aid in, and to let aid workers in. And then you need to let us work safely.
I want to thank you, Dr. Victoria Rose, for being with us. British senior plastic and reconstructive surgeon with the National Health Service has been on 3 medical missions to Gaza since October 2023. My final question is, your colleagues and yourself, why do you put yourself in this incredibly dangerous situation where hundreds of health workers, doctors, nurses have been killed, have been imprisoned?
It's difficult to understand unless you come here and see the difference that you make. We always worry when we come here that we might not be of any use, that we might get all our kit confiscated, that we might not have a hospital to go to. But what we always say is the main thing is to come here to bear witness, because you're not seeing what I'm seeing, because there's been a complete block to all media. So I'm here, number one, to bear witness. Number two, I'm here to stand with my colleagues. And these are people that I worked with before this war started.